Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Cloud Podcast, the podcast where we learn from cybersecurity experts how to stay safe, private, and secure on the cloud and in code. CSCP is hosted by Francesco Cipollone, your cybersecurity friend with a passion for all things cyber and sharing stories of other professionals with you. This episode is brought to you by the generosity of Phoenix Security Limited. Phoenix helps startups and enterprises solve complex software security supply chain visibility by leveraging the power of correlation and contextualization. Discover how Phoenix Security helps CISO and security engineers act fast, prevent burnout, and implement DevSecOps at the speed of cloud. Phoenix Security. Correlate, contextualize, and act on risk with one click. Let's dive in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Cybersecurity and Cloud Podcast. Today, we're here back in a discussion with something that we never talk about in this podcast, that is application security, software security. And I'm really happy that Josh came on board today, because we try to kind of have a discussion from a security perspective and from a development perspective, and trying to see if we can match or see the things eye to eye, or see things in the same way. So Josh Goldberg is an open source dev in the TypeScript ecosystem. But without me talking and saying all the blurb, I'll let Josh introduce himself. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, it's always funny trying to introduce people. Everyone has very strong opinions on who they are and what they do. But yeah, hey everyone, I'm Josh. I work in the TypeScript ecosystem on open source full-time. I'm independent. Projects I work on generally revolve around helping you automatically detect issues in your code, most notably ESLint and TypeScript ESLint. So always happy to talk about making code better, and in this case, more secure.
Nice. And you've been working in this industry for quite a while, open and closed source. How do you see the state of security versus clean code or secure code, in your opinion? What's your view on the industry right now? What do you think the kind of security code or secure code industries right now?
It's a really, really good question. I think the industry, interestingly, has very similar velocity to the velocity it's always had in terms of improving and better understanding how to do things, and is light years better than it was even 10, 20 years ago, but of course has a lot of room for growth. I think the inevitable cycle is we are constantly finding out the hard way how to do things bigger and better. And especially as software scales, we have bigger and harder challenges to overcome. It's a Sisyphean task trying to write secure code.
And with the, I'm going to ask the question of AI, of course, with LLM and all the other things, do you foresee that the code is going to get better or worse, or people would just ask, here, I have a Python script, can you convert it in TypeScript? Or here, I have this Java, very old JavaScript, can you convert it into TypeScript?
You know, it's funny, that's actually one of the projects I plan on working on this year. And most of the project will not involve AI. AI is really, right now, optimized for acting as autocomplete, really. Mm-hmm. It's not, the current round of AI is, of course, not tomorrow's. The current round are very imprecise, very hand-wavy, guess-oriented tools. So I think that they are helping, or able to help people write better software. I also think that a lot of people are using them the wrong way, very often trying to write an entire, let's say, class or function with AI and then just assuming it works. But that's natural, right? Every time we have a new type of dev tool, people get into this, it's called the Gartner hype cycle. We get into this peak of furor over how it's going to change everything. And then we learn the hard way where it does or does not. So yeah, long-term great, short-term mixed.
All right, fair enough. But there was quite an excitement. Is that because we don't have enough dev? Dev are expensive, or everybody wants to write code, but it's really hard to write good code?
Oh yeah. Devs are expensive. I definitely agree with that. I have no personal complaints about being able to earn six digits in my 20s. You know, that's not something my parents, their generation is accustomed to being common, but it is a little ridiculous, especially when you look at other career paths like teachers, for example, who are grossly underpaid. And I think we're actually starting to see the industry slide towards normalizing salary, where thanks to the efforts of so many people from boot camps and online resources and adding STEM education and coding in particular to schools, there are more developers in the market than there used to be, especially entry level, which is why, you know, we've had kind of a overabundance compared to the last few years.
Nice.
But and I mean, that's how it should be, right? Like it's silly to have an industry where very few people are there relative to the number of jobs available.
Yeah, otherwise you make superstar and yeah, it's hard. But I had a good discussion on that from a security perspective and actually a development perspective, where a good friend of mine, Jim Manico, that was on the show a few episodes ago, said, don't hire junior, just hire very good senior, and you can have one good senior to replace four junior. And that generate a whole mess in the more comments. And I'm not going to say by my moderator team was kind of under stress and duress for a little while.
I can see why that would happen. That is an incendiary area to talk about. Yes.
But yeah, I don't have a strong opinion on one or the other. I've seen very excellent junior developer. I've seen very crappy senior developer full of themselves, and the other way around. I think it's, as an industry, we have people and we have to deal with people, and you have excellence up and down. And also, for sure. Very positive on trying to create the new generation of senior developer. Otherwise, we're stuck in the rut of like, you have super high paid developer, but very scarcely available. And then everybody else end up writing their own code with LLMs and not the big Unity. I don't want to deal with that word.
Yeah, for sure. The way I phrase this to people who aren't technical when they're asking why is software developers being overpaid a bad thing? Well, do you enjoy bugs in your software? Because when you have too few developers for the software being written, it makes the software more expensive and development costs, whether it's security or quality or whatever, worse. So definitely wins all around if we get more juniors working at companies and are able to pay everyone.
Yeah, I mean, bug bounties and solving bugs is not very fun. It's more fun to create new library, new piece of code rather than, I don't know, what's your opinion on bugs versus endless bug bounty?
Well, every company needs to have security, right? In terms of, you have to have some way of learning about the security, of fixing it, of integrating something into your practices to reduce the amount of security vulns getting shipped to production. If your company is too small to have a large dedicated security team, then yeah, sure, bug bounties are good. If you're big enough that you're a target, then I would assume bug bounties are great there also. But as soon as you can, much like having a design system for the front end and tests for everyone, I think having a robust security reporting system internally and security auditing as part of your process would be another important part of the setup for sure. Thoughts?
So on that subject, actually, I wanna dig deeper into that. How do you set up a dev team for success when you have very few security resources that can actually look at the code, triage, because you can't dedicate one security resource to every dev team? I mean, I wish we were in that world, but it's a little bit unscalable because as software developer, the pure software developer are even more rare than just developer.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's funny. I think there's a really interesting parallel with accessibility here, because similar to security, most engineers have not specialized in this area, security or accessibility, but it is critically important for the team. And there are multiple reasons why it's important. There's the moral reason of, I would prefer not to, let's say, have my users' passwords stored in plain text and leaked, or be inaccessible to anyone who doesn't use a mouse. There's the legal aspect of, for both of those, you're liable. And then there's the financial aspect, you know, of getting sued or whatnot. So you do have some strong justifications for doing well in that area, but it is hard to budget for them. So how do you, you know, budget for them when there's not enough to go around? There are a few strategies there. I can just give you the high level of stuff I've seen work. Have some kind of checklist for your processes. I really recommend the book Checklist Manifesto, Checklist Manifesto, so that before you, let's say, start on a product, making sure that you've done an accessibility audit on the designs, talk to the security person, you know, set up an end-to-end test plan. Those are all things you are easy to forget, but you should do. And then sharing expertise in some way. If you only have one person who's quote unquote good at security in your area of teams, making sure that if you can't hire anyone else, that they're at the very least training others on the basics of it, the stuff to look out for, you know, passwords and plain text type stuff. And then lastly, setting up pairing sessions, or at the very least some kind of communication, so that if there is, let's say, a security task being done, it's not just siloed to one person, so that you have multiple devs who are learning about it and able to, you know, articulate its benefits later on. Does that all sound reasonable?
It does. And I will add as well, we have checklists as well from a security perspective. So OWASP has published a standard that is ASVS that's created three level of checklist that's enabled developer to actually write or have a kind of a checklist of things that should be secure in a specific way, level one, level two, level three. And then you have methodology from an OWASP perspective, as well as your security professional that you can talk to, and threat modeling or lightweight threat modeling, where you try to think about threats. And a good friend of mine actually has created an LLM-based threat modeling that, surprisingly enough, is very good if you describe the application and the technology in a decent way. It does a good job to scale your security team. So LLM threat modeling is potentially one thing to actually help scaling. Now, it's not very precise, and you need to give us every LLM precise input, otherwise you get garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, sure. But that's fantastic. I think that's a great example of folks using AI not to replace your, you know, development lifecycle or security processes, but to augment them, to automate or make easier the boring stuff, or the stuff that's easy to, you know, miss things on. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's bug bounty, and that's finding bugs in your own codes. I think there is an element where you can use AI as a tool, or not to be used as a tool. And that's a little bit of a joke on, don't become the tool that the AI used, but use the AI as a tool to actually augment your capacity and scale. Because I strongly believe that the next generation of security and development will use AI to kind of speed up certain things that are boring, because those are the things where LLM and certain AI are decent, not to write an entire library, as you rightfully say. What's your thought on that, Josh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every level of innovation in computing has been good at automating stuff only when it is possible for humans to appropriately direct it. We're years away from having any kind of AI or computing that can replace the complexities and the brilliance of even the silliest of the human minds. I mean, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, folks were talking about, ooh, this memory management thing, it's becoming really good. You know, I really like this. And now it's just part of the process, right? Like, you would never think to start a new application in C unless you really, really needed to, right? So I see, AI is a similar trend of making the tooling better that we then direct as needed.
This episode is brought to you by the generosity of Phoenix Security Limited. Phoenix helps startups and enterprises solve complex software security supply chain visibility by leveraging the power of correlation and contextualization. Phoenix platform connects to your repositories, scanners, and cloud, correlates all the information, and provides you with a prioritized list of vulnerabilities that need to be addressed first. Discover how Phoenix Security helps CISOs and developers remove friction and maximize the use of DevSecOps professionals at phoenix.security. Phoenix Security, correlate, contextualize, and act on risk with one click.
And in your experience dealing with other teams, dealing with other dev team, what are the metrics that kind of set up the team for success? And what are the metrics that kind of depress teams for unsuccess?
You know, there are some metrics that I think are kind of standard across the industry. Like, people try to assign pointing to tickets. You know, this is a bug fix. How many 1-point bug fixes or small size t-shirt bugs do we ship? And those can be useful. But I forget the name of this rule, but it's that whenever there is a previously good system, the system will be gamed, so it is no longer good. It's one of those things, you know. I think I like to see teams in terms of how happy they are and how flexible they are and how many bugs they ship. So there's actually another great book on this, Slack by Tom DeMarco, talking about how if you overload a team with OKRs or whatever other system you use for their deliverables, if you tell them that every quarter, every year, they have to be operating at top capacity, then you give them no flexibility, no slack in order to do things that aren't directly contributing to company or team OKRs, which means what's going to fall by the wayside? The intangibles, security, accessibility, stuff right. like that. So I think seeing that a team is able to adhere to its processes, what percent of a good process they drop is a really, really good metric. Or if they're constantly dropping, you know, creating then executing a test plan and then getting end-to-end failures, then that's a good metric that, or a good indication that they have some work to do on that metric.
That's an interesting thing. So in security, we usually have very basic metric, like how many tickets you saw, how much. In a more advanced topic, how much false positive you get from linters or security tool in general to actually make sure that the metrics are okay. But it's very interesting to, because that's my experience as well, that OKR and a lot of metrics or sprint metrics are pretty much driven by delivering in, delivering out. And it's just a consistent chain of tasks, and security kind of falls out of because it applies most of the time. Or you need to think systemically, not in component. So when you measure by component or individual unit of measure, you tend to suffer, or those metrics tend to suffer, or the intangible, as you rightfully say, tend to suffer.
Yeah, for sure.
What's your opinion then on service level agreements or SLA that, generally speaking, security people throw at a development community? Like, you shall like fix them. This problem by X amount of time.
An SLA is like a tank. It's very powerful and can get a lot done and can really force you in a good way to make sure you're doing the right thing. But tanks need support. I don't know how many people World War II strategy applies to, but you can't just throw one out there in the wild and expect it to do well in isolation. With SLAs, you need proper reporting practices. You need some level of not camaraderie, but at least rapport between the teams. Let me give you the most common example of I used to have working with security, not security team, just security. We used to get on the web platform team in my last job, dozens of security alerts about critical, you know, volumes in affected NPM packages. And of course, then you look into it and the package is like a nested dependency of a dependency that's only ever built on a developer's machine if it's Windows, like some crap that's completely unrelated to the actual application. And if you have an SLA in that context where you must respond to the security whatever's within, let's say, 2 days or a business week, then that completely invalidates the SLA. It makes you not want to work with the security team at all. And it's a complete waste of everyone's time. So yeah, SLA is good, but also proper reporting practices, adjusting what will or will not be reported over time, you know, making sure that it's actually valid communication about things that really matter. Those are the supporting things that I think are often required to make an SLA worth it.
So why don't we take a step back, and this is me talking to me as security person, and instead of pushing kind of myopic or blind metric like SLA that are flat, more into that conversation of risk reduction or letting team to say, why don't you figure out what's the best security flaws are actually need to be addressed, instead of me, security team, telling you those are the critical and all of the critical need to be addressed.
That's such an interesting topic. I love this so much, because the security team is going to be the experts in security within a company, unless someone has performed a drastic weird career switch. I guess not weird, unusual career switch. There's the security team is going to have the majority of that expertise, but the development team is going to have the majority of expertise on that same development team.
Mm-hmm. You just did a security troubleshooting of a security ticket not being security. So I think you're better placed to do that job and to have that judgment.
Maybe I'll make that career switch. But yeah, I think it's really interesting, actually, that there are a lot of common threads of you know, processes that are applicable in both, you know, lines, both teams. But you have these two somewhat siloed areas of expertise that need to come together in order to inform both teams' processes. How do you do that? You have to talk. You can't have one team throw its processes at the other and expect something good to get thrown back over the fence. That's not how it works. So you want to be informed by the security team on what is secure, and you want to work with the development team to understand what is their process and how do you fit it in. And it's impossible to do a one-size-fits-all solution. You have to have the two teams talk and work with leadership to make sure it goes well. No other way.
I love what you said at the end, that is security talking to development, talking to leadership, and kind of closing the triangle. Because from a security perspective, we spent probably a good 3 or 4 years trying to push, because we couldn't scale as a security team in application security, we pushed security tool all the way up to the development line called shift left. And we pushed this topic of shift left, DevSecOps, intermixed terms around the block for quite a while. But then the disadvantage of that is that we've completely lost control of security tooling, or the tooling were integrated, but we had absolutely no idea if something was getting fixed or not, because we kind of handed over the tools and say, security, now development, now security is your responsibility, it's your tooling. But then you don't have an understanding of what happened. So that communication is absolutely critical. And then there is one line of communication that is business to dev. And they expect feature to go out of the door very quickly, especially in this time of period, even more quickly. And security is not in their line, or they don't have a perception of their line. So if security doesn't have the perception of what is the status of the software and where it runs, how the heck is a business person even going to have an opinion?
Yeah. Strong agree. Yeah.
And I think that's where our industry is crippled right now, where we flung across tools and or metrics or problems to the development team, expecting them to kind of get along without understanding what a Scrum team is or what a sprint planning is. And our processes of security are not well integrated into that and can't scale into that process. So we kind of stuck in this method. That's why I like, and this is where I've seen success in using risk and letting team kind of figuring out what's the best way to address this in a week, to address all the security issue in a week, to dedicate a security week, to dedicate 5 story points in a security time, and letting the team kind of come up with the best approach, but giving them one OKR, that is reduce risk, and agreeing that OKR with the business so that the business pushes because their neck is on the line.
Yeah, I love that. I think whenever you can take an intangible, such as being more secure, and turn it tangible, that can be a very effective way of working with people who have to work only in the tangibles. But if you are able to phrase a risk as, you know, having this type of bug in production that's a known security vulnerability is a whatever percent, let's say 50 for sake of math, 50% chance of a $3 million you know, lawsuit or user issue or whatnot, that becomes a $1.5 million line item, which is much easier to convince a leadership person on than, you know, I just want to be secure because if we're not secure, then our users, you know, might suffer. You and I talking as humans are probably very motivated by the morality and practicality of security. But when it comes down to decision making, if it's not capturing the OKRs, the dollars. Yeah.
Well, we're talking the challenges. We're talking with business people, and we've been, as a security, we've been screaming on the board needs to understand that, but we also need to understand how business understand things. Like, it's money in, money out. Is I dedicate X amount of people time to actually write security things or write software. And it's a balance, it's a risk. Sometimes it's a risk that you can insure, say, F it, I'm going to create the most secure system around my software, and my software is going to be the buggiest software ever. But the risk of not going to market is much higher. And maybe when you put the monetary value next to it, maybe the business person thinks it twice, because losing $1 million is not like losing 10 critical vulnerability to a hacker. If a business person is accepting kind of 10 critical vulnerability because he needs to go in production versus he's going to accept $1 million worth of potential loss with a X amount of percentage and 10 critical vulnerability, I think the decision and the discussion are, well, at least it's going to be a pause and saying, do we even have liability to actually cover that damage, or is that going to happen? So, but we are talking money and risk with people that are well paid and well trained, hopefully, to understand money and risk, versus they're not very well trained in understanding critical vulnerability or sprint cycles or number of units. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, that makes total sense. No single person can understand an entire business past the point of small stage startup. It's not feasibly practical. If you have a, whatever, 1,000 person company, the CTO cannot have the information contained in every single one of the engineering managers. The CFO cannot have all the same information as the CTO. That's not how human brains and human processes work. So you need to translate things into ways that folks around you can understand. That's one of the basic principles of, you know, business communication. Now, the challenge then is that that's not a natural skill for most people. That's something that you have to build up and practice and learn about over the years. So an effective leader, someone who is able to help their reports articulate their needs and understand their needs, and then spread that to their peers and their leaders, is a very valuable person. And one of the things I think the industry is learning how to grow slowly over time.
But there is also an element of, I totally agree with you, and I want to say there is also an element of trust but verify. Like, the SLAs are kind of a comfort blanket of the security, because we used SLA for a very long time, or we use a version of SLA for a very long time. We keep on pushing this as, yes, as a security, we've done our job. We scan your code, and we say that you shall fix this in X amount of time. So it's a comfort blanket. Well, if we just say you have the risk control, it's your responsibility. As security, we suggest you the stuff that you should do. It's delegating control and kind of having not a baby conversation, but an adult conversation with a business leader or a dev team. Accepting the fact that something might F up or screws up, and it's very uncomfortable place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think there's a really interesting... I think there's an interesting long-term risk and financial process that you can find in this area. We talked about how the immediate, this is a bug, this needs to be fixed, can be factored into your financial computing. But what about processes? If you know there is a change to your process that'll, I don't know, make it 5% slower, you know, add that much ticket cost per quarter, but will have a significantly larger than zero chance of reducing a certain classification of security issues or other bugs, then, well, that might just be worth it to add to your processes. And oftentimes the really basic security stuff, like the things we were talking about earlier, you know, having a plan, yeah, going through an audit, that type of stuff might be very low cost and very high percentage improvement. So if you want to fix culture, that is one of the avenues of being able to articulate why you need to integrate these thoughts, these practices into your cycles early on, not just at time of release.
And I love that, because you can measure that. If you work with risk, you can say this process of fixing the, or doing a training on this particular category of vulnerability, or fixing this framework because you're going to fix systematically this kind of category of vulnerability, has an actual impact in monetary value and risk reduction, without where you can say, look, if you fix 15 vulnerabilities, it's going to take you, I don't know, 5 hours each vulnerability is X hours of development time. But if you fix this class of vulnerability by upgrading the framework, by creating a shared repository with a good library that's kind of clear that process. If we fix that process, or if we do this systemic action, then we have a systemic benefit. And it's really difficult to make that argument when you don't have risk number, when you don't have that quantification element, because it's like, well, you want to do a piece of work in security, what's the benefit? It's difficult to quantify the benefit security, because security is always a plus. In this way, you can help the security team, or the security team can help themselves in fixing stuff.
Yeah,
or promoting this good practice and good action.
Yeah. I actually really like what you brought up earlier about fear and trust. where we just talked about tangibles, you know, using specific percentage numbers, whatnots to improve processes or to justify. And then I think for a lot of folks listening to that, myself included, one of the first reactions is, well, I can make these numbers and I can make them believable, but I might not be believed. That itself is a bad. You want to be in an organization. You want to build an organization where leaders can come to each other with things that they believe. And instead of being shut down immediately about, no, those numbers are made up, I don't believe. It should be a conversation, you know? If a CTO goes to the CPO and says, hey, we need to spend 10% more per quarter on security, the conversation needs to be a productive one. It needs to come from a place of mutual respect and understanding where the CTO is able to articulate why, the CPO is able to articulate why that's a pain, and then they figure out what's best for the org along with the other leaders. It should never be just an immediate shutdown, no, I don't believe you.
But it usually is. Like, it's human against human. It's primal fear, and security is always stimulate the primal fear of, like, I need to drop something when my deadline and target are already so tight and are getting tighter. But those number or those systemic issue can help, regardless of how they're measured, they can help making that argument with your product person or your as a CTO or as a product person with the CTO as well, because I've seen also that happening, especially right now where security is an added value versus a drawback. Like, you can use it from a marketing perspective, from a product perspective. There are certain things that are kind of expected of you and from you as an organization, like multi-factor authentication that I don't see enough built as a default as a first feature on a product. Maybe second, maybe I wouldn't do first. Maybe I do the authentication screen first and then sure. The multi-factor. But it helps building that case.
Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, I get really optimistic about the future of tech, because as we learn the things that we want to do really early on, like having, say, multi-factor auth, even enabling two-factor auth, email verification, and so on, the platforms and the tools we're using as platforms are learning also over time. So it might have been, you know, very difficult. You set up a Rails app 10 years ago, and then you have to integrate with all these service providers and do it all manually. Now you use something like, I don't know, Clerk, and it's just all done for you, a lot of this stuff. And sure, there's always going to be some communication layer between your functions, your classes, your microservices, your external services. But when you use stuff that has been informed by the last years, decades of tech, it's easier to start building these things in from the beginning, which I think is a really, really nice sign of improvement for the industry.
Brilliant. And I was about to ask you, as we come in towards the time, to leave our audience with a nice, warm, and fuzzy positive message. I think you just did it.
Yes. Nailed it.
If you want to add another very positive message, but before we go in there, if folks want to hear more about your work, what you write, or your thoughts, where they can find more about you?
Sure. I'm Joshua K. Goldberg, K as in Kevin, on Twitter. My Mastodon server is Fastodon, Blue Sky, YouTube, Twitch.com. Although I should warn your audience, I don't actually do security things. This is just my history of working on teams, on a web platform team. And then I also do a lot with static analysis, which, you know, is a factor in security work. So just word of warning that I might not talk as much about security as some of your other guests.
But it's interesting because we only been talking about development and security, and we see things eye to eye. That's a beautiful
I think
part
so.
Of it.
Every time I talk to a security person, we end up bonding over something, whether it's root cause analyses and asking five whys, which is one of my favorite techniques in the history of techniques, or how people need to talk to each other more. I mean, there's always something, and that's part of why I'm here. I enjoy this. It's great.
Oh, that's beautiful. And yeah, if you want to leave on a positive note, aside from the couple of positive notes that we just dropped, which one will be?
Yes. I want to shout out, I don't make this thing, but there is an ESLint plugin. ESLint is the standard linter for JavaScript, called ESLint plugin regex or regular expressions. It has a rule that will detect redos vulnerabilities. So regular expressions with exponential, you know, if you input too much, it'll crash your app. And I don't have scientific numbers for this, but I'm pretty sure that the vast majority of automated security reports I get from my JavaScript ecosystem NPM packages are from redos vulns. So the fact that there is the ability in the community, in the ecosystem, to detect these automatically should really be a big sign that we should start adopting this more. And I think this is a warm fuzzy note, because that plugin, I'm starting to see it get used more and more. And I think we're going to have a lot fewer redos volumes reported in 2024. I hope, at least.
Brilliant. And yeah, I think from my perspective, the software maturity level has made leaps in the last 2 years versus the last 10 years of software security. So I'm super happy to see fundamentally developer security, maybe in a few years, business talking with each other around the same objective. And yeah, coming together to have this kind of conversation, because I think it's useful and reduce that level of fear. But Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here and discussing security with another fellow. I'm an ex-developer, by the way. So to turn into the dark side.
So this was an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Cheers.
Thank you very much. And everybody, if you haven't used Alinta before, just check what Josh has just recommended. If you haven't used static analysis, have a look at what static analysis can do in the context of your security delivery pipeline or secure SDLC. And have a conversation with your security or dev team, depending on which side you are on listening to this show, and help them understanding why risk and risk reduction can be a good OKR to help you freeing up from the shackle of SLAs. This was Francesco Spallone, your host and your application security geek. I hope you enjoy the show. Stay safe out there. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcast and post it on social media tagging Cybersecurity Cloud Podcast for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Discover other episodes at www.cybersecuritypodcast.com.